Hello everyone, my name is Rob. The following is an excerpt from a lecture that I gave as part of the Irish History and Cultural module at University College Cork Language Center in Ireland. If you want to find out anything else or other information about the course, you can take a look at the show notes for this episode. Enjoy the program. Hi everybody, so these lectures are intended for students of English language and they're written by me, who is a non-expert in any of the fields that are mentioned. So anyway, I hope you enjoy it.
Sound of his name in Dutch.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, so cool.
Yeah. So anyway, so I've taken this from Twinkle. You can see it in the right-hand corner. It's a great resource for teachers, either for primary school teachers, secondary school teachers, or third-level teachers. They have nice kind of simple PPTs that you can access on there. So this is the person we're going to be looking at tonight. So we're going to be looking at St. Brendan, or how do you call him in Dutch again?
Sint Brandam.
Okay. Right. So yeah. So we call him Neave Brandan in Irish. Okay. And he is, if you go to a place called Carcaguina in West Kerry, so that's on a peninsula, just in the western part of Kerry, then there are lots of place names that are associated with him and that still retain his name today. So for example, there's a place that it's a wonderful place for going either scuba diving or going snorkeling, called Cay Brendan, that's the place where supposedly he left to go on his semi-legendary journey. But I'm going to be talking about that in a little bit more detail. Who knows if it was legendary or actually if it really happened. So Jelska, do you have an opinion either way? Having studied this before.
An opinion about what?
About whether his journey to North America, whether it actually happened or not.
Oh, you know what, it was 15 years ago, so I don't okay. Really recall, sorry.
Okay. It feels like a legend anyway for you, like your experience in university studies. Yeah. Anyway, I'd be interested to hear your opinion. Maybe you will get reminded of it as you go through it.
I hope so.
Maria Teresa, have you ever heard of St. Brendan?
Yes, of course, but I don't know if here in Argentina or in Ireland, but I know who he is.
Mm. Well, who would be obviously we have St. Patrick, who is probably, you know, famous outside of Ireland, but are there, like, if I asked you about other saints who are also kind of well known here, well known in Argentina, I mean, from Ireland, is there any other saint
besides St. Patrick? Yes, St. Bridget.
But it is okay. Yes. Oh, really? Okay, that she would be known. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. So yeah, Saint Bridget is known elsewhere in Europe. I know there's a tribe and also I think an area of southern Germany. So it's the part of Germany near to the northern border of Switzerland. Now I don't know the name of it in German exactly, but it's near to Lake Constance, and there was a tribe there that the Romans spoke about, that for example Julius Caesar mentioned in his commentaries, and the name of the area anyway is Brigantia. Is that familiar to any of you? Have you the Brigantia?
No.
Yes, I think so, but How do you spell it? Or how can you repeat the name?
I think the way that it's spelled in Latin is B-R-I-G-A-N-T-I-A.
That is in Switzerland or in Germany?
Yeah, so it's in that area. It's just in Germany, but it's on the border, if you like, with Switzerland. But it's on the German side.
I think it is Bregenz.
Okay, that's in German, is it? Okay. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that tribe, right, they're named after St. Bridget as well. So St. Bridget, even though, you know, she's a Christian saint, and we associate her with Christianity today, the personality, and this is something that I've mentioned with a lot of other people already in previous sessions, the personality of St. Bridget was one that was pre-Christian. So Bridget was a goddess. She was associated with fertility and reproduction and the springtime. And you might remember when I was talking about the Celtic calendar a few weeks ago, I was talking about the 1st of February, right? So that's the feast day of St. Bridget in modern Ireland. But in the old Celtic calendar, it was the festival of Imbolc. So Imbolc means in the belly or in the womb. So it was like this fertility or this, rebirth festival. So Bridget has a very, very old identity. And another similar Celtic deity, right, who also has left their name and place names around Europe, particularly in the old kind of Celtic heartlands of southern central Europe, is Danu or Anu, okay, who is the earth goddess in the Celtic tradition, and she left her place name, for example, in the river Danube. So that's another place that's associated with her. And then in another one, now Danu doesn't really have a Christian version. It's one of the places, one of the let's say Celtic deities that's left its place name in Europe. There's been a lot of scholarly work into that, just looking and because one of the things about place names is place names are the last things to change. So place names have a huge amount of longevity, let's say. And then the other one that I'm going to mention, the other Celtic deity, is what we call in Irish Lugh, L-U-G-H. In modern Irish, it's spelled L-U accent. And that deity has left its place name on, the Roman province of Lusitania, which was where modern-day Portugal and Galicia were. And also on the city of Lyon in France, and a couple of other place names, that start with Lou around Europe. There's a pretty long list of them. So anyway, St. Brendan doesn't have the same sort of presence, let's say, as some of the other saints, but, it's interesting anyway, the sort of the signature in our place names that some of these early either deities or Christian saints left on the landscape, particularly in Ireland. So everywhere you go in Kirkaguina, in the Dingle Peninsula, particularly in the western part, you have, like Mount Brendan, you have Brendan's Quay, Brendan's Beach, Brendan's Field. So there's loads of places that are associated with them. And it's the interesting thing about place names, right, is that often the place name is not legendary. It often has to do with a historical fact. So there's a place where the British murdered a group of Spanish and Irish soldiers during the 9 Years' War in 1602, I believe. And the name of the place where this murder took place. Well, basically, the Spanish were in this kind of castle along with their Irish allies, and the British they surrounded the castle, they starved them out, and eventually the British said to the people inside, to the Spanish soldiers and to the Irish soldiers and their families inside in this castle, basically, if you come out and you give us possession of the castle, we will spare your lives. They came out, the British didn't keep their word, and they murdered everybody on the field. So the field's name in modern Irish is Gartna Fulla, Gartna Fulla, right? And our Gartna Nefali, or something like that in the English transliteration, the English name that, that a lot of people know if they're just monolingual English speakers in Ireland. So that, what that means in translated into English, Gartna Fulla, is the field of the blood. So anyway, this that place name was associated with the event for a very long time. And, you know, people thought it was, because that happened like in the early 1600s, right? So people thought that it was legendary and that like it didn't actually relate to any real event. Now, there were a couple of other stories that were in the folklore that the soil in this field, it became very fertile. Okay, so like blood has a lot of, you know, it's very fertile actually for the land, you know. So if there is you know, a battle on a field or something like that, then all of this blood that's spilt, it actually fertilizes the field. So this field was turned out to be much more fertile after this terrible slaughter. And also in the modern era, in the 1970s, they carried out, and some archaeologists came from UCC, from University College Cork, and they traveled down to the Dingle Peninsula, to Gartna Fulla, and they wanted to dig it up to see if there was any truth to the legend. And of course, they found a load of bodies, and also they found implementations, you know, like uniforms on the bodies, which were indicative of them being, you know, 17th century, early 17th century Spanish and Irish soldiers, and also their families were there as well. So there were some remainders, you know, not really of their clothing, because they had sort of biodegraded at this stage. But some of the metal objects, like their buckles on their belts and stuff like that, other metal objects that would have been on their uniform, they preserved. So anyway, they were able to say that was where the soldiers were murdered, and also where their bodies were buried. So sometimes this kind of place name or place lore, as it's called, often it has a lot of origins in real events. Does anybody have any comments about that?
No.
Okay, anyway, let's get on with St. Brendan. So St. Brendan was born in Kerry around the year 500 AD. When he turned one, he was sent to live with a local chieftain. The chieftain's name was Arda Mac Fidda. Now this was a very common thing to do in Celtic society. So people would foster their children out. It was a way of maintaining agreements and maintaining loyalty. And also the person's son or daughter would benefit from the fostering, because they would learn maybe how to read and write. They would learn how to farm. They would learn whatever skills, maybe farming skills or whatever was needed. So anyway, he returned to his parents at the age of 5. That was kind of unusual, maybe a little bit on the younger side. And then he studied with a person, a local, very early Christian figure called Saint Erc. Now, if you look at what Ireland looked like, let's say at 500 AD, the traditional age or date that Patrick is given, landing in Ireland and spreading Christianity. And also there were, I think I mentioned this before in a previous lecture as well, there were other Christian ministries that were sent by the Pope in Rome, who arrived and who were already spreading Christianity before St. Patrick. For example, a figure called Duncan, who is associated with Ardmore in County Waterford. And then there's another one, I think his name is Palianus or Palianus or something like that. I don't know his name exactly, who was sent directly by the Pope. So these figures were already spreading Christianity around, particularly in the southern part of Ireland. I think St. Patrick is normally associated with the northern half of the island. So that's where he did most of his missionary work. And that's where he has, the highest number of place names are associated with St. Patrick. So you have Crow Patrick, for example, in County Mayo. You have Down Patrick in County Armagh. These could quite possibly, Palladius. Thank you, Maria Teresa. Yeah, Palladius, exactly. So that's Palladius. So Palladius was the first one to come over. What's the date actually with Palladius, Maria Teresa?
No, I only know that he arrived before St. Patrick, but exactly when, I don't know.
Okay, maybe that's something one of us can check. Maybe if somebody has Wikipedia open, they could have a look and see what date
I can do it
associated with Palladius arriving. But anyway, I know that the legendary or the kind of folkloric date that's associated with St. Patrick is 432. Now, of course, people like Palladius and St. Patrick, they didn't convert the whole island to Christianity straight away. Remember, these were people who had very ancient beliefs. They had the old Celtic gods and goddesses, and you know they were, so 408 to 431, died 457 to 461, the first bishop of the Christians of Ireland. There's an interesting thing about Palladius. There's a lot of legends, particularly legends about St. Patrick in the folklore, right, that were actually things that Palladius had done. So that's what happens sometimes in folklore, the further away that you get from the actual historical events, that the two people, the two historical figures of St. Patrick and Palladius, they both merge together, and in the folklore they appear as the one figure, the one kind of legendary figure. But what historians think now is that they were two separate figures. In fact, we're certain of that. There's enough evidence in Patrick's own hand, as he wrote his Confessio, which was his kind of sort of biography, that he wrote his confession, if you want to translate it into English, that he wrote just before he died, where he gave various details about his life, which many of these details were historically verifiable. But the Confessio is written in Patrick's own hand. There's also a letter that was written by St. Patrick, again in Latin, that was written earlier in his life. So we know that St. Patrick was a real person. And same with Palladius. There's enough evidence out there that says that he was a real person, that he actually came to Ireland. So Ireland, had experienced a lot of missionary activity before even St. Patrick arrived. But by the time St. Patrick died, let's say towards the end of the 400 AD, Ireland hadn't been totally converted to Christianity, not even close to it. Some areas certainly had, but the outlying regions, particularly the western peninsulas, for example, the peninsulas in West Kerry and Cork, it's probably down to figures like St. Brendan, or maybe even his teacher, St. Erc. Those were probably the trailblazers, or the pioneers, I suppose, when it came to spreading Christianity in Western Ireland. And each of the other kind of territories have their own saints who are associated with these periods. So, for example, Saint Bridget in Kildare. Now, don't get Saint Bridget confused with Bridget, the Celtic goddess. Again, what happened in the case of Bridget, the Celtic goddess, and Bridget, the Christian saint, was that her personality as a goddess and her personality as an early Christian ministry, again, they amalgamated together into the one figure that we know of today, really, in folklore as Saint Bridget. So she was associated with spreading the religion, you know, in County Kildare and, you know, the mountainous regions around County Wicklow as well, the Wicklow Mountains. So there's lots of, you know, holy wells associated with them in those regions. Then you have, you know, Saint Enda in County Mayo. You have Saint Machtara in West Galway. Then you have Saint Columbkilla in Donegal, Western Donegal. And you have all these kind of saints all around the place. So there's a saint as well in my local town, right? So I'm from just outside of Cork City. And the local saint there's Saint Laffan. And then there's another one, Saint Cuan, and they're dated to sort of the 6th century as well. Often what's left of them is just a name, and their names survive really in place names. Now there's a holy well that's associated with Saint Cuan as well, which if anybody's interested in visiting it, you'll have to wait obviously till after the lockdown, but it's about a 20-minute 15-minute car journey maybe from Cork City. Anyway, St. Dark baptized him. So this probably suggests that he came from a pagan family. And when he was 1 year old, and also ordained him in 510. So that's the age we're given. Obviously, he would have been very, very young when he was ordained there. So I don't know how historically accurate. Yeah, exactly. Jelska just asking the question there. Yeah, was he 10 years old when he became a priest? That's what we have written. We have written documents supporting that. But maybe they had a practice of, you know, ordaining children when they were younger at that stage, but it seems kind of very, very young altogether. So I don't know, maybe it's a mistake, who knows. But anyway, that's the year that's given in the surviving documents. I'm just reading Maria Teresa's, can you read out that message, Maria Teresa, that you just put up there about Palladius? Or actually, I could just
okay.
Read that.
Yes, I can. Yeah. Palladius was born between 408 and 431 and died between 457 and 461. Was the first bishop of the Christians of Ireland, preceding St. Patrick. The two were perhaps conflated in many later Irish traditions. What you said.
Yeah.
He was a deacon and member of one of the prominent families in Gaul. That is your last name?
Yeah, no, it's very close to it. But Gaul is, it's basically modern day France, maybe parts of Belgium and the Netherlands.
Ah, yes.
Gallia,
yes, of course. Pope Celestine the First consecrated him a bishop and sent him to Ireland to the Scotty, believing in Christ.
Okay, so that's taken from Wikipedia, right? What's the original source?
Wikipedia. Just a minute.
Maybe you can just put on the chat just in case
Yelska
or Akane might be,
I am doing that,
or anybody else might be interested in where the original source of that is. Just one interesting thing that I want to mention from that, just from a language point of view. So conflated is a nice verb where it means, you know, two things come together to form one identity, particularly two personal identities. It can be, you know, when you confuse two things, or you conflated the two ideas together. They're two separate things, actually. So we use it in that sense as well. And a deacon is, I believe, somebody who has been ordained, but who is also able to get married. So they're priests, but they also can be married. So as far as I know, that's the meaning of deacon. Now, there still are, I think that position still exists to a certain extent in the Catholic Church, but I don't know for sure the details, but I think that's what it means. Also, consecrated him, so that's the verb that we use with when you're given holy orders, so you're consecrated. So that comes from the Latin, so you have sacra, you know, like sacre coeur, you might know in French as, you know, sacred heart. So it's comes from sacred as well, that we would have in English. So with sacred is what the two kind of strands, the two morphemes there of that word mean if you translate them into English. And then the Scotty, so the Scotty refers to the Irish. So the old name in Latin for the Irish was the Scotty. Now, Scotland didn't exist at that stage, but Scotland was named after the tribe of the Irish. They were called the Scotty. Okay, so Scotty is the same as saying the Irish at this stage. So there weren't many Scotty in Scotland at that stage, only very, very few. Okay, so yeah, I'm just seeing the link there. Thanks for sharing that, Maria Teresa. So you can go on there and you can check the original link. But anyway, that's just a kind of a little bit of a background of what Ireland was like at the time. So if you can imagine, you know, the kind of more populated areas in the more fertile regions of the country, you know, in the eastern parts, you know, Christianity probably would have been fairly widespread at this stage, you know, when St. Brendan came to adulthood, let's say. But in the more remote mountainous regions, in the boggy regions, in the regions where the soil isn't very good, so in the regions, you know, that are kind of where you have to Gaeltacht be, if you like, today, the Irish-speaking regions, this is where probably at that stage in the mid-6th century, like 550s AD, let's say, where, you know, maybe the pagan beliefs and the old kind of, you know, Celtic beliefs were still very much being practiced, and probably Christianity hadn't extended to those regions. So it was, you know, a time where Ireland was converting still from being a pagan Celtic country to a Christian country. And it takes a long time, you know. People will argue maybe that a lot of the old pagan beliefs, if they ever died out, they only died out maybe like in the 19th century. Okay, so anyway, as soon as St. Brendan became a monk, he founded many monasteries around Ireland, okay? So found, you might have seen that verb where it relates to, you know, like I found something, but maybe founded, you know, like this past form, so it's not the usual past form. So normally find is found, right? So I lost my book, but I found it yesterday. But founded is the past of when you start something. So when you begin a company or when you begin a school, okay? So you might see that word associated with, you know, whoever was the first person to open the monastery or to open the school or whatever. Okay, so it's an interesting verb that you will see often. You will see it maybe on, you know, old kind of primary schools that you will encounter when you're going around Ireland. You will say, oh, founded in 1894 by such and such a person. Okay, so anyway, he founded lots of monasteries around Ireland. So he started lots of monasteries around Ireland. And there is a well-known monastery of his in Clonfert in County Galway. And he also founded monasteries, particularly in County Kerry, in the area where he was born. Okay, so there are remains of his monasteries in County Kerry still today, and they're still holy places. So we have things in Ireland still today that are called, they're called the patron days, right, or their saints' feast days. So there's the one associated with one of his monasteries, the ruins of one of his monasteries in Kirkcaldy, right, so in the Dingle Peninsula. And on the patron day, right, so this is P P-A-T-T-E-R-N, right, like patron in English, but it comes from the Irish patroon, which is associated with the Latin, you know, patronus, all right? So it's associated with holy figures, basically. So on the pattern day, you do what's called the round, right? We say in Irish, na trusana. So the rounds is where you go to the holy places associated with a saint. And often it involves, you know, going three times around the holy well and saying a certain number of prayers. And you do this in lots of different places. It's like kind of doing the stations. So there are still a lot of places where these patron days are still celebrated. I mentioned Ardmore, which is connected with St. Duncan down in County Waterford. Another saint in Cork is St. Gobnet, who's particularly associated with the Gaeltacht in West Cork, Gaeltacht Búscri. So her holy well and her monastery is still there, and people still go there on her feast day. So that tradition is still alive. Now, these going to do the Trusana, going to the place on the Saint Patron Day. It was also kind of like a fair, and they would have lots of games there. There would be lots of people selling stuff. It was a big shindig, or a big hupla, a big kind of party, if you like. And they probably got very rowdy as well. You know, people would be drinking on this day as well, near to where the rounds were going on. So it had a religious association, but then it had kind of, it developed this kind of festival atmosphere as well, which I know happens in other countries as well. For example, you know, I lived in Seville for a while. I remember in the month of April, usually nothing ever happened in Seville. From a work point of view, because everybody was going to, you know, La Feria, and they would just go and celebrate. And that was, you know, associated with Semana Santa, right, so Holy Week. So, you know, there was a lot of celebrating going on, and, you know, St. Patrick as well. We call, there was a tradition of toasting Patrick's health, and people call that Pot Padraic. So you'd basically have a drink to Padraic's health, to St. Patrick's health. And, you know, that descended into the absolute chaos of the debauchery that you see in modern day St. Patrick's celebrations. So if you've ever been in Cork or Dublin, you would see it basically. You have a parade, but then it's kind of, it's all about drinking, really. Although they are starting to kind of do more kind of family friendly events, which is a positive movement. But, you know, in the 20th century and latter half of the 19th century is very much, you know, kind of a drinking party. Have you ever attended St. Patrick events, Maria Teresa, in Argentina?
Yes, we organize that kind of parties, but not in a pub. Okay. It is a family feast, if you want. It is for a family, and we spend the whole day trying to, for example, we organize hurling or Gaelic football games. Nice. Such things, but not well, if you want to drink, there is no problem, you can drink, but it is not what we promote.
Okay. I was just thinking as well, in Holland or in Japan, does anything happen for St. Patrick's Day? Like, have you ever seen anything going on in the bigger cities there? Is there any?
Well, there are lots of Irish pubs, and I guess they celebrate it over there, but I never paid attention to that. Sorry.
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, maybe this is me being cynical, but I'd say probably a lot of it is just like pub owners trying to make money. You know?
I guess. Yeah,
because I suppose it's a good way to promote your pub.
Yes.
But I like the sound of what's going on in Cordoba, Maria Teresa, with the Gaelic games that are going on.
Yes.
mm-hmm. other cultural things. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, I suppose it's not the healthiest, really, to be, you know, just kind of focusing no. on alcohol. And it has, no. you know, I think it's gone a bit that way in recent times, you know. It's very much, you know, kind of a drinking party. People don't understand, or there's not really much else besides the break. Yeah, how about Japan, Akane? Good question, Yelka. Yelka just asked, how about Japan? Have you ever seen, Akane, anything happening?
I'm not sure, but I guess maybe there is Tokyo. Tokyo is, yeah, they have an event in Tokyo, I think.
Okay. But can you remember any particular ones or anything like that?
Yeah, no.
Okay. Anyway, so yeah, I remember, like, I've celebrated St. Patrick's Day in a few different countries, and usually there's something going on, but, you know, it's usually amongst the Irish community, but sometimes you have people who are part of the Irish diaspora. Now the place probably that has the biggest St. Patrick's celebrations is either, I would say, New York, Boston, or Chicago. Probably one of those three cities in the northeastern part of the United States. And certainly the St. Patrick's parade in New York is the biggest. It dwarfs the one in Dublin, as big as the Dublin celebrations are. And then in other countries, like, for example, Argentina, Australia, or Canada, you know, with Irish heritage connections, let's say, you know, there would be celebrations there as well, and parades. Is there any parade of any description that you know of, Maria Teresa, in Argentina?
Yes, in Buenos Aires, there is a parade. Mm. Not so big as in Boston or Washington or New York. It is something big, a big event.
Okay, great. So thanks for that. So let's get back anyway to St. Brendan, right? So Brendan, right, the reason why he's probably so famous outside of the fact, you know, that he was an early kind of Christian missionary. Now, he was only a minor missionary in comparison, you know, to the likes of, let's say, Columbkill or Palladius or St. Brendan. So Brendan is best known for his voyage to this is translated from the original documents, which explain the journey. So translated into English, his voyage to the promised land of the saints. So Brendan heard a story of this land, like this mythical land, from a visitor to his monastery in Kerry. So on this island, day never ends, and the rocks are jewels. Now, that word jewels, it may just mean that the rocks are very bright, or even that it's covered in snow. You know, so it could be that the rocks are covered in ice. Right. So when you translate it like that, you know, like there are different ways of interpreting the word when you translate it into English. Like that happens sometimes when you're translating, you know, very old documents. So these documents are kind of contemporaneous with St. Brendan. So they're dating like from, you know, the 500s, 600s. So the ones that were written, you know, very close to when the historical St. Brendan actually was around. Just seeing a message there from Akane, who's sending us a link to St. Patrick's Day parade in Tokyo. Wow, so even in Tokyo.
Yes.
Amazing. Yeah. I have to laugh because, like, Tokyo, it sounds like, you know, if you had Sullivan after Tokyo, it would sound like an Irish name. Like Tokyo O'Sullivan. you know, that the O part of Tokyo sounds like, you know, O that we have in our surname. So I know that Maria Teresa's ancestors were O'Sullivan. So anyway, they did. They made that kind of joke as well with Barack Obama, you know, because Obama kind of sounds like an Irish name. So a lot of those Irish names, you know, they begin with O. So they found out, the genealogist found out, they found out that Barack Obama is actually, he's 1/16th Irish. So one of his great-great-grandparents traveled over to the United States from Ireland. So when he came here, he visited the town that this person was from in a place called Moneygall. So there was a song as well that the people of Moneygall wrote about him. So anyway, but it was just good-natured fun. And Barack Obama being, you know, he's a very charismatic person, but he went and he had a pint of Guinness in the pub in Moneygall with the locals. So it was kind of, it was an event that was on the news. You can find it in YouTube as well. You can find this song. So it's quite funny. So on this island, anyway, day never ends, and the rocks are jewels, or the rocks are made of very bright ice. Right? Are you beginning to imagine what place?
No, I wanted to ask what which island could be, because yes, if you have snow,
then
you
paradise.
Don't have. Yes, you don't have warm air. I don't know which island could be.
What about the, you know, the day never ends? Is there any?
I think it is in the in that is perhaps Greenland, but could be. Yes.
Yeah, it could be. Okay. So somewhere that's above, you know, the Arctic Circle. You know, so if this person, like, let's assume for a second that he actually went to a real island, you know, it could have been, Jelska is saying Greenland as well there. So it could have been Greenland. It could have been Iceland even. I'm not sure. Maybe somebody can confirm whether how close it is to the Arctic Circle and how long the day is during the summer. I don't think it's quite a 24-hour day, but there may have been other islands as well. I know there's an island which is a part of Norway, and it's an island as well where they would have 24-hour day during, you know, the summer as well. So it could have been that, but probably Greenland is, you know, Greenland is probably where people are thinking of. Anyway, every tree had fruit, which was good to eat. And every plant had flowers with wonderful smells. The air was always warm. Now, we know, right, that the planet goes through periods when the planet warms up and when the planet kind of gets colder, right? We had ice ages. So the reason that, and maybe some of you have heard this story before, right? The reason that Greenland got its name was that when people went there, when the Vikings went there, right, we have quite solid proof that the Vikings traveled to Greenland and set up colonies there, that when they went, the climate of the earth was much warmer, and southern Greenland wouldn't have been covered in a glacier like it is today. I know there's the southern tip that, you know, that I think still doesn't freeze in part of the year anyway, at least. But possibly, you know, it would have been, you know, covered in green a lot more. There would have been a lot more vegetation. It would have been a lot more of a fertile land during the time that this person went there in the 500s. So we can look, you know, people, scientists, they can look through glaciers. They take samples out of glaciers. And in these samples, they can sort of go and they can see what the climate was like in our history. So, for example, they can see what the climate was like. There was a year in 1814 it was, which was known as the year without summer, when there was a volcano somewhere in modern day Indonesia. And this volcano spewed a load of kind of dust into the air, and it stopped the sun. Basically, people couldn't see the sun for about a year, and it destroyed all of the crops and things like that. And we could see evidence of that when they looked, you know, at the glaciers, when they were able to look at the glaciers, because in the glacier, when they mined down and they drilled into the glacier, they were able to find, you know, samples that were from different historical eras. So they could look at a sample of the glacier that was from that particular year, and they could see evidence of it in the glacier. So the scientists can look back, and they can look back to, for example, the 500s AD, and they can look at what the climate was like when that particular ice formed in that glacier. They can find out, for example, what the atmosphere was like, how warm it was, etc. So maybe, I'm sure probably some of you know a lot more about this than I do, but they were able to use that to look at what the climate was in around this time. And apparently the scientific evidence supports the theory that the climate was warmer then, and that possibly, you know, Greenland could have been much more of an attractive, fertile land covered in greenery at that time. So maybe this may be Greenland. So anyway, Brenda was very, very excited about this land. So he decided to find it. So the next morning, remember that there was a tradition of saints going to kind of very isolated places. For example, I want to show you in this, I'm just going to show you some photographs here, right, of some of you maybe have visited this place. So this is just to tell you about the tradition, right, of going to very isolated islands and setting up monasteries there. So there was a very strong tradition of that in the early Christian church. It kind of started like in places like Mount Sinai in Egypt, in very isolated parts as well of Ethiopia. Early Christians set up kind of monasteries there. You know, it's very kind of nomadic, and people would go off into the wilderness, copying, I suppose, you know, part of the gospel where Jesus went off into the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, you know, that you may have heard about before. So the Irish monks were keeping with the same tradition. They were going to, you know, the most isolated places that they could find, and they were setting up base there, sometimes on their own, sometimes in communities. And they thought that, you know, in these isolated places, they could meditate and they could feel closer to God. Right, that was the theory, at least. So Skellig is one place that they went to, and there are remains of a Christian monastery from early Christian Ireland there today. The monastery doesn't exist anymore, so it's just ruins. And this island as well became very famous recently because of its appearance in Star Wars. So if it looks familiar, maybe some of you might have seen it on Star Wars, right? It was used, I think, in a couple of the episodes of the new trilogy. But if you get a chance, guys, I highly recommend you go and visit Skellig Island. Yeah, it's an incredible place. It's basically a rock that just goes. You don't really get a sense of how high it is there. But yeah, Skellig Island, Skellig. Yeah, so Skellig. Yeah, so that's Skellig Island, and you know, it's an incredible place. Now today, like, there's a staircase going up to where the monastery was. The staircase is quite frightening when you take it, but imagine, you know, they cut this staircase, these early Christian nomads, they cut the staircase out of the rock. Imagine, you know, if you're climbing up just the side of the rock, you know, the dedication that it would have taken and perseverance that it would have taken to do that. So, you know, it's not beyond the bounds of imagination or possibility that St. Brendan may have decided that he wanted to go to this island that he heard about. Okay, so that's Skellig. I'll just return to the PowerPoint. Okay, there's maybe some other pictures that I'm gonna refer back to.
Sorry, Rob, can I ask you?
Yeah, sure.
You mentioned, sorry, this is totally off topic. Barack Obama, was it a money goal?
Money goal, yeah.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Money goal. Yeah. I can type it as well.
I found it. So yeah. Money goal.
So that's where his great great grandfather was from, I believe. So anyway, he's 1/16th a money goaler, and they treated him as if he was, you know, a lost son coming home when he arrived there on his visit to Ireland. So like Barack Obama was a very popular figure during his visit, and unlike Trump didn't have an official visit, but anyway, so Saint Brendan was very excited, so he decided to go and find this land. The next morning he started to build a boat with some fellow monks. Okay, now think about the kind of dedication and just, you know, perseverance that would have been needed, you know, to climb to the top of Skellig. So these are the same types of people who decide to go off into the unknown, right, of the Atlantic Ocean and find these places. Now, there may have been knowledge about these places from, you know, fishermen, maybe, you know, Iceland and places like the Faroe Islands, possibly even Greenland around this time. So he may have known about these places, and he may have used these places as kind of stepping stones to get to the New World, let's say. Okay, the boat was made from oak and ox hide. So that word ox hides is ox skins, right? Or ox, you know, their skin. You basically dry the skin. So it's very, it would have been used like for the sail, for example. So it's a pretty simple boat, you know, with just kind of one sail. And it's very similar to the modern day carrock that you have in, right? So carroch is the word that they use for these types of boats in Galway. In Kerry and in Cork, we call them naivogi. So naivog, it's N-A-M-H, O fada or O accent G. There's a place actually in Cork called Mehl Mara, right in Cork City. It's down in very close to St. Finbar's Cathedral. And it's a place where they still make these naivogi or these carrocks in the traditional way. And they also take on volunteers. So if you're ever in Cork and you want to experience, you know, what it's like to build one of these traditional carrocks, you can do that down there in Mehl Mara. And I know that Mehl Mara as well, they take on refugees, so they give work experience to refugees there and pay them a wage. So they have a couple of Syrian guys making these naivogi there as well. So it's a great little project. I can type that into the chat as well if anybody's interested in finding out more about Mehl Mara. What Mehl Mara means, by the way, is it means Mehl is sort of a working group. So like a working group of the sea. Okay, so anyway, team of the sea, maybe, I suppose, would be a better way of describing it. So, Mehl Mara. Anyway, so that's the kind of boat that he built. And so soon, Brendan and his friends were ready to set sail. They loaded up the boat with enough supplies to last them 40 days. Now, guys, when else did you hear 40 days?
From the Bible?
Yeah. So you see that, you know, there's things like this that are coming in, and obviously they're things that were added later on. They're things that are legendary, all right? So 40 days is something, you know, it didn't start with the New Testament. It's something, you know, that goes right back to the Old Testament. So 40 days is a very kind of auspicious, 40 is a very auspicious number. For the ancient Hebrews or the ancient Israelites. And then through the Judeo-Christian tradition, 40 became a very auspicious number for journeys, and particularly journeys that were dedicated to going into the wilderness in search of God. So anyway, it said that they set sail from, well, There's a theory out there that they set sail from Ballynavinbora in County Kerry, or from Cay Rendon or Brendan's Keep in County Kerry. Okay. So you see Vinnorach there refers to the name of the boat when you translate it, or when you transliterate it back into the original Irish. So the voyage took a very long time. On the way, now these all come from the written records, you know, the documentary records that we have from the biographies that were written about St. Brendan just after he died. Quite recent to the time that the figure of St. Brendan historically was around. So on their way, Brendan and the monks met other Irish monks and local inhabitants in the various other locations. So that's Britain as well. So, you know, they were probably visiting monks or, you know, maybe nomads that were living on the Faroe Islands, some of the other, maybe the Shetland Islands. Perhaps even Scotland, you know, they may have kind of traveled up the west coast of Ireland and then onto Scotland and then, you know, the Shetlands and the Faroe Islands and made their way over to Iceland in that way, you know, in a kind of stepping stone way. They kind of name the places, but it's hard to figure out if the places that they're talking about are, you know, which historic or which actual places on our modern maps they're talking about. They were welcome wherever they went. So they were probably, you know, if they were meeting non-Christian groups, they wouldn't be welcomed, I don't think. So that kind of suggests to me that they were probably meeting Christian outposts. And they were given fresh supplies as gifts so that they could continue their journey to the promised land. Interesting food that they received. Yeah, so on this slide, right, is food that they actually were given, right? So these, it's not kind of random food. Also on the previous slide, the flowers, these are the descriptions of the flowers that were in the documents, and there were drawings of these flowers as well. And now it's interesting, right, if you historical horticulturists have studied the drawings of these flowers, the drawings that are in the documents about St. Brendan. And, you know, they sort of think that these are the kind of flowers that you would have found in Greenland at that time. Okay. So anyway, they were picking up these kind of foods. So, and the descriptions of the food is very clear. So, you know, there may have been, because the climate was warmer, remember, they may have been, there may have been a lot more kind of, let's say, land-based agriculture in places like the Faroe Islands or Iceland or places like that, you know, if it was warmer. So who knows, or maybe they could have traveled to the south. Maybe, you know, they may have had oranges because maybe they had some kind of early form of greenhouse. Who knows? But these are the fruits and foodstuffs that were being mentioned that they picked up. And so this meant as well that, you know, if you're on a long sea voyage, one of the things that happens, and at least that happened to people that were on the voyages associated with Christopher Columbus to the New World, and people got scurvy. So scurvy is a disease where your gums start to bleed, they start to get infected because of a lack of vitamin C, you know, your immune system starts to get weaker and weaker. Eventually your sort of gums start to bleed and your teeth can kind of fall out. So it's a very serious disease for sailors. And it's the reason as well why there's a slang term for the British, which is limey. So the British Navy used to keep limes for their sailors to stop them from getting scurvy, okay, because there's a lot of vitamin C in limes and lemons and things like that, and they had access to a lot of lime plantations in the Caribbean islands, And then the Germans, they got their vitamin C from cabbage. So from sauerkraut. So cabbage, they would put it into, they would marinate it, you know, put it into sort of a vinegar, and that would preserve it. And then they would give their sailors sauerkraut. Do you know anything about the Netherlands and the sailors and explorers that were coming from there? Jelskan, and how they kept healthy? And how they kept their nutrition levels up?
I was typing, and then I thought I might as well just unmute. But I also know about this. I think I also heard something about some fish they used to salt the fish, so it was okay. Also eatable later on. I guess it's also cabbage, because that's also something that grows in our area.
And it's also one, like, it grows well in Ireland as well, and you know, it's just an easy one to preserve by marinating it. I love sauerkraut, but it's not really kind of a traditional food in Ireland. But like, if you go into any of the Polish shops in Ireland, they always have sauerkraut. It's not really something you eat in the Netherlands, is it, Jelska? It's more kind of Germany, probably.
No, we do eat it. Yeah, but and actually, it's this exact same name. We also call it something like sour. So it's also sour is both that something is very bitter, and also that when you're mad, you can also say that. Yeah, and we have the same word.
The slang term for people from Germany, you know, this is not a term that you should use. Same with limeys. These are, you know, can be offensive, but I'm just telling you for, you know, just for cultural reasons, right? Just to help you remember the words. But the slang term for Germans is kraut. Now, it's not very rude, but it's not mm-hmm. polite either, you know, kind of mm-hmm. calling Irish people paddies or something like that. So that was because, you know, the German Navy would keep sauerkraut below decks in order to make sure that their sailors didn't, end up having vitamin C deficiency. So limeys for the British sailors, and then krauts for the German sailors. And it went on to sort of describe anybody from Britain and anybody from Germany. Okay. So the Americans, especially, like when I say the Americans, I mean people from the United States. I know that can be frustrating, can't it, Maria Teresa, when people say Americans when they're just referring to people from the United States, if you're from another part of the Americas. But anyway, yeah, I wish there was another adjective, like a nice adjective for describing people from the US. You can say, I suppose, yeah, the people from the US, but it's a bit of a mouthful. But anyway, you people from the US or people from the United States, they would refer to the Germans as krauts and the British as limey. So if you ever watch World War II films and stuff like that, then you'll see those terms being used. So just reading out this from Maria Teresa, now that you mentioned Columbus, he was in Galway 20 years before he came to America. Really incredible. Wow. I didn't know that. Thanks for sharing that with us. And according to the legend.
And there is an inscription on a church, because it is said that he went to the church and prayed because, I don't know, he wanted to go back to Spain. But I know that there were two or three Irish men on board when he arrived in America.
All right. Wow.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Thanks for that bit of research that you did there. Yeah. So two or three Irish men on board when Columbus arrived in America. I don't like to, personally, I think it's very kind of Eurocentric to say when Columbus discovered America, because like there were people living there long before Columbus arrived. But I suppose it's when, you know, the modern European world found out about the Americans, let's say. Anyway, I think it's important to make that distinction today, you know, because it kind of disrespects the you know, the people that were there and the cultures that were there before Europeans arrived. And also, I think, you know, there's good evidence that maybe the Vikings were there and that possibly other groups were there, maybe even St. Brendan. So Jelska, just seeing your question, what did they call the Irish? So I was saying that the kind of the slang term, now this is one that can be offensive, right? So, you know, it's kind of a disclaimer before it, but you hear the word paddies being used, like I said earlier, and also yes. Mick. So from Michael, the short for Michael is Mick. So they particularly use that in the US, like in New England, mix. Now it can be used as well in a non-offensive way, like mix can be used in a non-offensive, like a kind of a joking way or a teasing way. But I would avoid using it unless, you know, it's with someone you know very well. And why paddies? Well, paddy, because of... yeah, because a lot of people are called St. Patrick, or a lot of people were named after St. Patrick. So Patrick is probably the most popular Irish name. Certainly, you know, when the Irish were going to the Americas, when they were emigrating in the 19th century, you know, that would have been a very, very common name for men. So, yeah, that's probably how it started, because they were named after Patrick. So anyway, so paddy, P-A-D-D-Y. Also, paddy is kind of from Padraic, right? But Padraic is spelt with a D, right? It's P-A accent D or A-I-G. So paddy is sort of, you know, the short form of Padraic rather than Patrick, because you're right. The short of Patrick would be Patty with a T. So Patty does exist as well. But yeah, paddy would be more from Padraic. And also there's a brand of whiskey from that's brewed in Middleton, and it's called Paddy Whiskey, which is a very nice whiskey. I recommend that you try it. But you know, remember, like I was saying, I wouldn't be using paddy with people unless I would say don't use it full stop. It's just not a Yeah, it's kind of an offensive word, or it can cause offense. So probably best to veer away from it. And then Mick from Michael, as I was saying. So anyway, let's continue with St. Brendan's journey. So anyway, he was picking up food along the way, picking up things like grapes, oranges, apples, eggs, also... He was picking up carrots. So, you know, there's probably farms that were going on in the areas that he was visiting. Now, just on the topic of farms and fertility, right? So they saw many strange and exciting things on the voyage, like volcanoes, right? So maybe you're thinking of Iceland, but it's an area of a lot of volcanic activity, where, you know, the tectonic plates are meeting. And we know, you know, only about like 10 years ago, the flights around Europe were grounded due to the ash that was in the atmosphere after one of the volcanoes erupted in Iceland. When was that, guys? Can you remember? Was it 2010 or something when all the flights were grounded because of that volcano? And nice one. I don't know, 2010 maybe. Yeah, I'm not sure. But anyway, on his voyage anyway, St. Patrick found and his followers saw a lot of volcanoes, which they described in their writings. Okay, 2010. Thanks, Jelka. The one day the monks landed on a small island. Nothing grew on this island. They got out of the boat and they built a fire on the island. Suddenly, the island began to shake and move, and the monks rushed back to their boat and quickly set sail. They looked back at the island as they sailed off. They were very surprised at what they saw. So what do you think they saw? You just cut out there, Maria Teresa. Can you say that again?
A volcano, I don't know how to say in English, eruption?
Yeah, eruption? A volcanic. So volcanic is the adjective, a volcanic eruption. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Could have been that. And it could have been, you know, like we've seen in modern times as well, islands forming from volcanic eruptions and forming new islands. You know, we've seen that happening in, you know, like recent history. I think there was one case in the late 20th century and probably another case in the early 21st century, I believe. So we know that islands can form from volcanic eruptions, you know, from the lava when it cools down. So it may have been something like that as well. Remember, like the description there, right, is that the island began to shake and move, right? And then they rushed back into their boat and quickly set sail. So, you know, it may have been one of these volcanic islands. Who knows? All right, so let's go on to the next slide. Anyway, this is the story now. The monks said that they had landed on a giant whale. Now, I'm not sure how true this is. Perhaps, right, now, it's kind of hard to believe that the whale was alive, right? But if the whale was dead, often whales are kind of quite buoyant if they die. And, you know, they could have been floating on the surface. That could have explained it, okay? Also, you know, it could be just a legend. We don't know. But, you know, this could have been an actual event. Who knows? Okay, so anyway, the promised land of the saints. So after the long trip, Brendan and the monks finally arrived safely to the promised land, or North America, as we call it today. So this is what the legend says, and that's what is written in these documents. The men spent some time exploring the new land. They sampled new foods and gathered some up for the trip home. Now, they brought some of these plants and foods back as well. And they made drawings of them. And these drawings have been extensively studied. And anyway, there is good academic evidence out there that some of the plants that they took back, they only grow in bringing home invasive alien species. Yeah, it's true. But anyway, they did bring back like certain plants and, you know, drawings and things like that of plants and animals that don't exist anywhere else except in North America. But it could have been somewhere in the North American continent, okay? Somewhere in Canada, Western Canada, perhaps, or Nova Scotia, or somewhere like that. So the men set sail for Ireland then, and arrived home after weeks of traveling with many stories of their adventures. So is this fact or fiction? Some people believe that the story of St. Brendan and his voyage to the promised land of the saints is a made-up story, is an invented story. People have tried to prove the story, as I was explaining to you, by making the same journey in the same kind of boat and trying to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. Now, somebody in the 1990s did that, I remember, and traveled on one of these curraghs, the type of curragh or nighboat that would have been available to St. Brendan and his contemporaries. And they managed to go over to the United States and travel back. So, guys, what do you think? It's over to you now. Do you think St. Brendan's story is true? Do you think it's a mixture of fact and fiction? What's your opinion about it?
I think it is true. Why not? Why not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's reasonable. Like maybe with these stories, I think often, you know, it's a combination of some, you know, legendary factors, you know, that were added on in the years after, a little bit like Palladius and St. Patrick. But that doesn't mean that, you know, like it didn't spring from an original historical event.
I think these stories are really cool because they, I always imagine that maybe Harry Potter in 2000 years, they will think that Harry Potter reigned over Europe or anything like that. And
yeah,
that's the same. I see some kind of analogy, or yeah, how do you say
analogy.
That?
Analogy. Nice.
Yeah, yeah. Between between this these stories and then the stories that we read in our times, and then yeah. But I think these stories are lovely, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And is there anything else that you can add, or did this remind you of anything when you studied these stories?
Well, I was thinking now of, do you know Thor Heyerdahl? He's a Norwegian, and he had this Kon-Tiki story.
Okay.
Are you familiar with him?
I'm vaguely, but can you remind us?
Yeah. So he thought there was some. It had to do with how to reach specific islands in somewhere, and he built a what do you call this? A really small boat that is more. It doesn't really have a roof. It's more of a float or a raft, and then he just took on a voyage of I don't know how many kilometers or miles, and then they actually reached what they wanted to reach. This is modern day Saint Brendan, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks very much for that. That's amazing. There's also you may have heard of Eric the Red. Thanks for the link.
Yes.
There. Guys, Jelska just shared a link to Thor.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting story. I didn't know that much about it. I kind of vaguely heard of Kon-Tiki because there's a tour company that I didn't work for, but I used to work for their rival. So I used to be a tour guide around Europe, around continental Europe. So there was a rival tour company. I worked for educational tours. And then there was a rival tour company called Kon-Tiki. They spelt it though with a C, and I think Kon-Tiki were Australian, but that's how I remember finding out vaguely like about Thor and this story. So thanks for that. I'm gonna read about that a bit more. There's a great movie about him as well. Brilliant. That's one that we can watch. I think, guys, there are a few documentaries as well that I want to share with you about St. Brendan, if you're interested in finding more out about him and more out about his story, maybe a little bit more out about early Christian Ireland as well. So anyway, the slides are copyright of Twinkle. Okay, and then I just want to show you a couple of other photographs as well, and ones that are kind of just give you an idea of other aspects of early Christian Ireland. So this is a picture that's taken from the Book of Kells, okay? So the Book of Kells was a book that was written, we think, in a place called Ilan E, or the English name for it is Iona, which is an island in, the Curragh is a bit like a canoe, Jelska. Yeah, I suppose, but the Curragh is especially built for like the ocean. You know, so it's very good for the really kind of rough seas of the ocean. So canoes are kind of more inland boats, let's say. But anyway, this is from the Book of Kells, Lower Cananish. So it comes from a place called Kells or Canon, which is in County Kilkenny. It was found there, it was discovered there in, I think, in the late 19th century. And it's just a copy of the Bible, the New Testament, the four Gospels of the New Testament in Latin. But what's really important about it is the decorations in the manuscript, you know, all the colors that they used and the sophistication of the drawings. You can see how detailed they are there if I kind of zoom in. So that's the Book of Kells. And the Book of Kells was written in Elam E in Western Scotland by Colum Kill and his Irish contemporaries on that island. So you probably know that the Irish took their language and culture to Scotland, and that's how they ended up speaking Irish or Gaelic in Scotland, and it's still spoken there in the West today, you know, in the western sort of seaboard of Scotland. So that's Colum Kill. Colum Kill, he went to Scotland to convert a tribe that were there. And this tribe, they're known to historians as the Picts, P-I-C-T-S, right? So they're a Pictish culture. We don't have very many remains of their culture. We don't know what language they spoke. We don't have any remains of their writing. But they did have a culture of, you know, standing stones, of sacred standing stones like we had in Ireland. So perhaps they were a Celtic culture. Maybe they were related to the same language family as the Basque language. We're not sure. Interestingly, the name for them in Irish is Nakhratnik, which is the same word for wheat, right? For like trigo in Spanish. How do you say wheat in Japanese and in Dutch? W-H-E-A-T, the cereal.
Graan.
Okay, like grain. It kind of sounds like grain, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and in Japan?
What?
W-H-E-A-T. Like W-H-E-A-T. That you make bread out of, you know?
Sorry,
W-H? E-A-T. So I know what it is in Spanish.
It's,
So W-H-E-A-T. Wheat.
Yes.
Yeah, so trigo, mm-hmm. Right? You say in Spanish?
Trigo.
I know the kind of one, you know, tres tigres comen trigo en un trigón. I kind of learned that when I was studying Spanish.
Difficult. To pronounce.
Yeah, it's not easy to pronounce even for me, but anyway, so that's the name in Gaelic and in Irish for the Picts, Nakhratnik. So, you know, that suggests that maybe they were a very agricultural society, and the areas that we associate today with the Picts were in eastern Scotland, where, you know, the land is quite fertile, but would have been suitable for wheat agriculture. And so, you know, like, these are kind of some of the things that we know about the Picts. Very, very limited. But anyway, Colum Kill is the patron saint of Scotland, and he's the patron saint of the Picts. The Picts ended up becoming Gaelicized, and most of Scotland, you know, spoke Irish or Gaelic up until, let's say, the time of Richard de Bruce or Robert de Bruce, who was, if you've ever seen Braveheart, he's the Scottish king he's the one who isn't king, but who's trying to become king along with William Wallace. And so he was kind of the first English speaking king of Scotland, right? That was in the early kind of 1300s, early 14th century. Anyway, that's the pick. So Colum Kill is associated with Scotland. He's the patron saint of Scotland, and also with Donegal. So I went to a few places that were associated with him, holy wells and things like that when I was up in Donegal. Here's our local saint in Cork City. Okay. So this is taken from the church, you know, inside in UCC. So this is St. Finbar. Okay, so you have the Honan Chapel in UCC. So this is taken from St. Finbar. Usually depictions of St. Finbar, depictions of St. Patrick are very similar. And this particular picture here as well is a picture of from Iona, from the island, you know, that Colum Hill set up his monastery and where the Book of Kells was written. And the Book of Kells, the reason that it was found in Kilkenny, even though it was written in Western Scotland, was that it must have been taken to this monastery. There's a monastery in Kells. It must have been taken there, maybe perhaps to avoid the Vikings getting their hands on it, you know, around the time that the Viking raids started. They started in 785 AD. So there's a few other slides as well. This is where you can see Iona. So guys, if you're interested in another session, so Iona is this small little island. It's one of these, I can't remember which one, but I think it's this one here, right? At the edge of this peninsula is Iona. And there's still a monastery there that's associated with Colum Kill. This monastery became very famous, and to show you how famous it was, all of the kings of Scotland were buried there up until, you know, the kings of Scotland became the kings of England as well. You know, there was a conflagration of the two crowns. So Seamus the Sixth of Scotland became James the First of England. And the Act of Union happened between Scotland and England. After that, the kings of Scotland and the kings of England were the same, and they were buried in Westminster Abbey. But up until that, all of the kings of Scotland were buried in the grounds of this monastery that had been started by Colum Kill from Donegal. So these early kind of Christian ministries, ministers and missionaries from Ireland, they had a large effect in Scotland especially. So guys, we leave it there for tonight. Like I said, I've been recording the session tonight, so I hope that's okay. Let me know if you've got a problem with that, because I'm going to share it with some other teachers, trainee teachers, if that's okay with you guys. Okay, so that's perfectly fine. Thanks, Jelka, for that message. Okay, and also, guys, in that folder that I shared with you that I'm just going through now, there's some other presentations, there's some other materials that you may be interested in. You're welcome, Maria Teresa. Thanks very much, and thanks again to you as well for inviting us to the book club. I'm excited to participate. No problem. So guys, I'm going to stop recording now.